and haven't gotten as far through the material as I thought I would, but that's probably not a bad thing, because perhaps the material I have covered has been clearer than it would have been. So today I'm going to talk about agency, and then if I finish that, I'll start on a possibilistic formulation of GR. And then on the last lecture, which is not next Monday but the Monday afterwards, I'll finish the possibilistic discussion, or start it, and then hopefully also talk a bit about where the whole project might be going, quantum gravity and such like. So I talked a little bit about agency last time, just at the end. So the idea is we want to do something similar to what we have in quantum theory. So in quantum theory, we have operations, which are these little boxes which have knobs on, and they have apertures, systems can pass in and out, and we have outcomes. So here's a box. We have, you know, different lights that can flash, red, green, or blue, and just one of them flashes. We have holes which systems can pass into and out of. And we have these knob settings. And the analogy for these outcomes in the approach I've been talking about is the gamma set, so a region of operational space. You have these gamma sets, and that would be the analog of a particular outcome. Well, you can coarse grain and consider different sets of gamma sets, and then those coarse grain sets would correspond to your outcomes. Also, incidentally, we have the analog of the systems that pass through, because when you wire these things together to make a circuit, then you arrange it so that the systems pass into appropriate apertures on the other boxes. So appropriate meaning that it has to be the same system type. And then in the case of these operations, we can wire them together. In the case of these regions of operational space, we can put them next to each other. So the wiring, the apertures, the analog of the apertures are these typing surfaces I talked about. But we don't have the analog of these knob settings. And then at the end of last week, I talked about an example. So you could imagine a captain, would be in general relativity, a captain who has a spaceship, steering wheel or joystick or whatever it is, and then there's a sail sticking out the top, and you can, as the captain, can rotate the sail different orientations and also increase or decrease the size of the sail. And then this sail may interact with some kind of wind. So this will be a fluid described in general relativity, you know, like a dust fluid or something. And there have actually been proposals for spaceships of this sort, where we use solar photons to try and propel a spaceship out into space. And now this captain, you know, he changes this, and of course then the spaceship moves, and then since that's a different distribution of matter, you'll get different gravitational fields according to what the captain decides. So in general relativity, the usual point of view is this kind of block universe point of view. Chris Fuchs wrote a book called My Struggle Against the Block Universe. So this is my struggles against the block universe. So the block universe is, you know, you look at the field equations of general relativity, and to write down a solution, it seems to you need to do it all at once. You have to write down a solution on the whole of space-time all in one go. So you get this kind of block universe, and if you change anything anywhere, you've got to change the whole thing and consider a different solution. In that point of view, what you would want to do is you'd want to take the captain and the neurons inside his brain and take them right back to the beginning of the universe and evolve forward, so the whole thing would be somehow determined in one go. And there wouldn't, in that point of view, be room for agency. So an alternative point of view is where you actually introduce agency into the equations. And it's actually not so difficult in GR. It already has the necessary technical machinery, at least to do some of the job. I want to introduce agency in a properly operational way, so we have to go a bit further. But I'll show you how we can do it. So in general relativity, we have fields. So I want to take this spaceship analogy and just use it to motivate a sort of field version of in which you can have agency. So imagine now a vast fleet of spaceships, more extreme than in Star Wars. You have millions and billions and billions of spaceships. Each of them is controlled by a captain with a sail and a joystick and so on. And so since it's a vast fleet, it comprises a dust fluid. In general relativity, a dust fluid is a fluid in which each parcel in the fluid is moving geodesically, unless it's acted upon by some non-gravitational force. Okay, and the dust fluids are very simple in GR to treat. The equations of motion for a dust fluid is just given by setting the covariant derivative of the stress energy tensor to be zero. So we have a dust fluid, and then also we have a wind fluid. So we have two types of fluid. So each of them will have its own stress energy tensor. So here's the ship fluid, and since it's a dust fluid, its stress energy is given by this very simple equation. This is the mass energy density. And this is the four velocity of each parcel of the fluid at a certain point. Okay, so that's the stress energy tensor for the energy momentum tensor for the ship fluid. And then also we have a wind fluid, which will have its own stress energy tensor. And we're going to assume that's a dust as well, so we have the same form. Maybe I could just now a complete set of equations for this system. We have these two fluids interacting. A complete set of equations is given by the ship, since the wind fluid is actually interacting, the two fluids are interacting, the covariant derivative of this won't actually be equal to zero, but will be equal to some four force density. This is a four force density acting on the ship due to the wind fluid. And then also, there's a force density also acting on the wind fluid due to the ship, and it's just equal and opposite. That guarantees that if you take the covariant derivative of the sum of these energy momentum tensors, you get zero. We also have the Einstein field equations. And then the only thing we need to complete this would be some equation for this four energy, so this four force density. So we can imagine that G is controlled by the sail setting. And this is a vector which we take to be normal to the direction of the sail. And then the magnitude of this vector is proportional to the size of the sail. And then we'll have some equation for G in terms of chi. So here's an example of an equation. I didn't actually sit down and work out what the right equation is. I'm not sure if there's a unique way of saying what the right equation is, but here's an example. I think the right equation would depend on how the sail was constructed and what assumptions you made. I chose this example just because it guarantees that the force is on the ship fluid is in the direction of the normal. Let's see. If you transform to the center of mass frame of the ship fluid, then the wind velocity would be, if the wind velocity is zero, then this force would be zero. So those seem to have good properties, but I don't make any claims for this being the right equation. It's just to illustrate the point. I'm not going to actually solve these equations. I never solve equations. Okay, so, but the point here is that you can see this chi field is doing something particular. It tells you about the choices that the captain makes. Okay, so the chi field is, I call it an agency field. So that seems good, but there is a problem. Any comments, questions, guesses what the problem is? Okay, so the problem is that we're trying to give this operational treatment where everything is specified in an operational way. That means it has to be expressed in diffeomorphism invariant language. But this agency field is a vector. It transforms under diffeomorphisms, and so it's not expressed in diffeomorphism invariant fashion. So it isn't quite. You can't say, you know, the captain can't say I decide to set the vector to have this value in some sort of abstract language. You have to give something which is diffeomorphism invariant that he decides to set, and then maybe determine what this is from that. So here's the solution I propose to that. So we're assuming we have this set of scalars S, and these could be constructed out of the scalars we have here. We could also imagine that actually the situation is a bit more complicated than what I've given you, that there's other scalars around as well that we could measure. But in any case, we have some set of scalars. So we have okay, this is the these are the scalars that define our operational space. And now I want to define a set of scalars that are defined in terms that are functions of these scalars. So we could just choose the function that the x scalars are just equal to the s scalars. Or we could choose some other function. We could choose the first n scalars from here to be the x scalars or something else. It doesn't matter. And now we can write, I can define another set of scalars now, these chi n scalars. Like this. So the sort of intuition here is you could almost think of these x's as providing a kind of a sort of coordinate system in terms of the scalars, and then we're transforming from this abstract coordinate or from this you know this background coordinate system that we can't directly measure into the physical coordinate system that we can measure. We can see these x's, so these things become actual scalars that we can be aware of. They count as operationally observable quantities. Okay. So this trick I got this trick from the paper by Westman Sonego. So once you've got this, now we can define Q, which is just the list of these scalars. Now we're going to say that Q is the thing that we set. In particular, we'll say at a certain point S in our operational space, we set sail to Q. Strictly speaking, we should say at a certain point S in operational space, we would set the sail to Q because, you know, our operational space is some big space. Then we have a certain gamma surface. And most points in operational space are not actually realized, don't actually belong to this gamma surface. But a certain point, you know, the point is that we say that we would set it to, at a certain point S, we would set it to Q. That's the sort of thing we can decide. Any questions? And really, this is sort of the captain, you know, he's looking at the sort of the stuff that's around him, which he sees in terms of S, sort of, he sees himself being in a certain part of this this gamma surface, and then he can decide to set the sail in some orientation against the stuff that's around him. Of course, we have this vast fleet of spaceships, so there are different captains making their different decisions.
Why did we change the coordinate system from S to X?
I could have just stuck with S, but I wanted to just make it a little bit more general and say, well, maybe the captain doesn't want to look at all the points in operational space, but some subset of, so all of the scalars, but some subset. And here the analogy is with, is that maybe these are the coordinates he's thinking of as providing a position, something like position. But you could have just chosen S. That would have been fine too. Okay. So this was a particular example where we had a sail, and the agency field for the sail was given by a four vector that was normal for the sail. We may have that our agency field is given by something more general. So it could have it could be some more general tensor. If it has mixed up indices that are up and down, you can always use the metric to take them all to the upper position. And then we can define scalars in the same kind of way as before. It's the same idea as before. And now we can say with our Q, the set of scalars that that we set is the set of those things. We may have an even more general situation where we have a situation that's described by many different agency fields, not just one agency field, but a whole set of different agency fields according to different choices. And then our Q would just be given by the list of all those things, all the scalars that we can extract from those fields. Okay. Again. Nope, not to listen to me. Remember this, the logic is different on the two. Yeah. There's a scroll button that's supposed to just rotate the boards, but it doesn't work. This one. Okay. So the next idea, so we talked about an agency field, and then we had a set of scalars that we can use to give us things we can actually get our hands on. And now a new notion is the notion of an agency, of an agent strategy. And so the idea is we choose an agent strategy for some region of operational space A. Okay. We do that by specifying a choice of Q at each point in A. Each point in that region, specify a choice. So what that means is we have this. So for each point in A, we've specified a Q. And we call that QA. And this is the analog of the settings that we had at the top. So the analog over there of the knob setting is QA. Okay. So what it translates into when you're looking at solutions is that we demand that these scalars calculated at each point are in this set here. Where we calculate these scalars. From the solutions, psi tilde. That are in the solution site A. So we're demanding that these solutions have the property that when you calculate these scalars, they're in the set U sub A. And you could think of that as being a sort of generalization of the notion of an initial boundary condition. It's not really a boundary condition, but it's a condition that you're imposing on the solutions. It's one that is living through the whole of your space time. But you can see you need something like this because when I gave you this set of equations, we had more variables than equations because we need some extra equations to tell us what the chi's are. Otherwise, we have more real parameters than we have field equations. Any questions? So it should be said. You can get degeneracy in operational space, like I've talked about before, so that there can be multiple points on the manifold that plot to the same point in operational space. And correspondingly, it can be the case that actually these constraints don't give you enough information to fully solve this set of equations. And then you'll have physically different solutions that are consistent with all the constraints that you have. And I describe that in the paper as jitter. You know, if you're driving a spaceship, or more likely driving a car, and the steering wheel is a bit shaky, or there's some slight disconnect between the steering wheel and the engine, then you'll have some jitter, and you don't have complete control. And so that would be what was what's happening in this case. Okay. So we've introduced this agency field, and it's sort of an effective notion, because we don't want to solve for what's happening inside, you know, the captain's brain. We don't have to sort of put the neurons in the captain's brain into our equations. We want to have some kind of coarse graining, so we don't treat those degrees of freedom. We just introduce them when they become relevant. So it's an effective approach. But when we do this, there's another effective notion that has to arise as well, which is that we only want the captain's decisions to affect the future. But if you look at the equations of general relativity, they're time symmetric, and so the future isn't singled out. So we have to put some extra structure in to single out a time direction at each point. Let's see what happens if I do this. Useless. So at each point on the manifold, when you have a solution on it, there's the metric, and the metric gives you a light cone structure. And so it picks out a double light cone. And what we need to do is add an extra field which singles out the future, what we nominate as the future, over the past of those two light cones. So we can just do that by specifying a vector, tau mu, which is somewhere in the forward light cone. It's sort of an odd situation. You just want to give one bit of information, the future over the past. But there's no way I could think of specifying that single bit of information with a zero or one. You have to actually give a direction. But then you can see you have some redundancy, because any direction in here would do. And so far as you're concerned, all the different directions, any direction in the future light cone would be physically equivalent, would be specifying the same fact about the time direction field. So what that means is if they're all physically equivalent, then if tau mu is a time direction field, then tau mu tilde, actually I'm realizing tilde is a bad symbol to use because I've used it to specify something very particular in the rest of the lecture series. Let me just call it tau mu. So this is a transform field. And we're transforming it like this. And this is a transformation which leaves the vector tau pointing in the same light cone. Okay, it's easy to write down what form this would take. It's just a if you transform to a local inertial frame, then it's a Lorentz boost that doesn't reverse the time direction. Okay. So we'll say this is the sigma is the set of time direction preserving transformations. So if this is a time field and we act on it with a time direction preserving transformation, then this is equivalent. Physically equivalent. Okay. So we've introduced, in order to accommodate agency, we've introduced two extra fields, the chi field and the tau field. So we have to include those in the way that we represent our solutions. So we write our solutions down like this. Is that clear? So in addition to the phi fields that give you the metric and the matter degrees of freedom, we also have these chi fields that correspond to agents' choices, and the tau field that corresponds to the time direction. Any questions? So one thing that played a big role previously was applying diffeomorphisms to solutions. So here the situation is a bit more involved because we still have the diffeomorphism symmetry, but we have an additional symmetry on the time direction field. So we have So now we have a bigger class of transformations. So I'm going to write down very difficult to draw the different types. This is meant to be var theta, LaTeX var theta. try again. Yeah, I think that's good. So, which is equal to sigma and var theta, var phi, sorry. So the var theta is the transformation we now have, which consists of the time direction transformation, which only acts on the tau field, and the diffeomorphism, which acts on all the fields. and we'll say that these transformations are an element of a set G plus, where sigma is a time orientation preserving transformation, and phi is a diffeomorphism. And if we apply the theta transformation to one of these solutions, then we have to do what I said, which is we apply the diffeomorphism to everything in here. The p is just a dummy variable, so you can transform it to q, then you can write it down as p again. And to tau, you have to apply both, you have to apply sigma as well. All p in. You also have to transform under this diffeomorphism the manifold. Are there any questions? No? It's clear that this is a bigger set of transformations than just the diffeomorphisms, because you could imagine that one of these fields in here was a vector that happens at some particular point to be proportional, to be parallel to tau. But then after this transformation, it may no longer be parallel to tau, because any tau that's in the forward light cone will suffice. So throughout the earlier lectures, there were all these notions that used diffeomorphisms, and now we have to just enlarge that to be this bigger group, this G plus group. So, for example, the pure state is given by acting on this psi tildes. With all thetas in this G plus group. And also, previously, we talked about boundary conditions. And to the set of fields that we need to check at each point where the boundaries meet was previously given by specifying a direction field. smoothness field. The fields that are in your physics here, some derivatives of those fields. And now we have to add to this also the chi field and the tau field. We might even want to add derivatives of the chi field in here as well. It doesn't change anything that I say, really. Okay. Any questions? And then there's another subject that I'm not going to talk about much, but let me just mention it, which is causality. So there's a lot that can be said about causality, I say some stuff about causality in the paper. I think there's a lot more that could be said about this subject. The important point is that now we have this operational notion of agency in general relativity. So we can talk about causality in terms of agents doing things and effect in the future. And in the standard formulation of general relativity, you don't have that machinery. So you'll see definitions of causality in the literature for standard GR. But this gives you some extra tools to bear on the problem. And in the paper, I write down some definitions of causality, but it would take me probably another two lectures just to cover those, and it's sort of technical. One thing I was aiming towards, for those of you who know about it, was something analogous to the Pavia causality conditions in quantum theory. So there are these conditions that the deterministic effect is unique. Basically, there's a unique way of ignoring the future. So if you have some stuff here in the future, this is the future, and you're interested in some probabilities down here, well, these probabilities don't depend on the future. So any way you ignore the future amounts to the same thing. In technical language, the deterministic effect is unique. So I was aiming towards something similar in the case of general relativity. I don't think it's more complicated because the causal structure itself is dynamical. And so what I've written in the paper doesn't fully capture this kind of Pavia thing, but I think that's the direction to move in. Okay.
Essential, and like if later on we want to do quantum gravity and this would be like a very critical thing that you need to have.
Absolutely, so I would say it's the crucial point. So I've only got 5 minutes left, so maybe I'll just talk about this instead of talking about possibilistic things. So in the case of quantum gravity, the sort of analogy I want to push is it seems to me that there's an analogy that in special relativity, well, even in circuits. So in circuits, you have a notion of causal structure, which is given by the wiring. And then you have the Pavia causality condition. In special relativity, you have eta mu nu, which is the metric. It's constant everywhere. If you go over to, you can look. There's a kind of version of quantum field theory that I talk about in the paper. I call it the operator tensor version of formulation of quantum field theory, and it contains an analog of the Pavia causality condition. So a sort of QFT causality condition. And this causality condition needs to look at the metric, just like the Pavia causality condition needs to look at the wiring. So actually, these causality conditions, they're a bit more general than that. What they accomplish is two things. I call them physicality conditions in a paper. So they achieve two things. First of all, they guarantee, this is in the context of a probabilistic theory, they guarantee that your probabilities are between 0 and 1. Because if you get probabilities that are outside that range, you have something non-physical. And then also the guarantee that you can't signal into the past. Where the past is defined by the wiring condition here, by the metric in this case, there is some implicit time direction field also in this. And so then the question is, well, what about GR? It would be nice to know what the analog was of this kind of causality condition in the context of even just classical GR. Incidentally, in each of these things, you'll also have a causality condition in the classical case as well, like in the quantum case. And it's very similar. So if one can work out what the causality condition was in the classical case, then one would have something to try and generalize to the quantum case. But at this stage, I don't really know how to do that. And it all looks a bit messy. I'm hoping it will clarify at some point. So the last lecture next week, I'll give a summary of the possibilistic formulation. It's a bit, I won't have time to go into it in great depth, but I'll just show how you can use this sort of compositional calculus where you put together operations and then you have a way of calculating whether that configuration is possible or impossible. And that lecture is on not on the coming Monday, but the Monday after that in the space room. One complication is that there is the announcement of the Center for the Universe starting at 3 o'clock. So it means we need to finish pretty sharp. Okay, thank you.